The Lucas child, Christopher, was 1 year old when he was rendered a paraplegic at a U.S. Army hospital in El Paso. He appeared at the hospital with a temperature. He was given a shot of a drug called LA, long-acting bifilin, which is a penicillin derivative, by a corpsman and a nurse at the government hospital. They gave him the injection in the wrong place with the wrong needle, and the apparatus and the methodology of the system was also in error. Christopher was immediately rendered paralyzed at the time and has since been paralyzed all of this time. He has, in addition to his paralysis, they operated on his back to see if perhaps he had a tumor or some other difficulty that was causing his spinal cord not to function. At that time, they broke open 5 of his vertebrae, and they are still presently floating. So he has a scoliosis problem because they cannot rod his back until he grows sufficiently so that he's not deformed in the trunk as well as in the legs. This case happened approximately 7 years ago as of next week. And it's real easy for me to see how old this case is because Christopher was 1 at the time and I've had the case from literally the first day. Christopher is now in the 2nd grade. It's a little easy to deal with a baby. If one is having to deal with a paralyzed child, it's obviously, as the years go by, it gets to be a worse and worse problem. The case was tried in the United States District Court in El Paso. The Honorable Harry Lee Hudspeth heard the case. Judge Hudspeth gave a verdict of approximately $3 million. I think it's $2.956 million. There was a third-party defendant in the case, which we had settled with in state court. Wyeth Laboratory was the manufacturer of the L.A. bifilin. The government took a credit for the payments made by Wyeth Laboratories to the plaintiffs. The case went on to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. Judge Hudspeth ruled that Article 4590I did not apply to the United States as the statutes were written and referenced. As the court knows, 4590I reverts you back to Article 4437, which lists the people that qualify under the statute. The government raised that issue approximately 6 days through trial, which to us, we really didn't deal with it at all, except the court just rejected it. The Fifth Circuit, however, held that that was sufficient raising of the issue. And then, of course, the Fifth Circuit, as you know, said that Article 4590I indeed applies to the United States, despite the fact it's specifically excluded by 4437, despite the fact that the government hospital owes no responsibility to the state of Texas for licensure, accountability, funding, and most, I think the evidence was in the case, that the people are not even required to be licensed by the state of Texas or any other state to practice in a military or a veterans hospital. That law has since been changed. I think in 1986 there's a statute presently pending that was approved whereby the people in these facilities now have to have a license in some state to act. Prior to that time and at the time of this incident, they did not.
Counsel, I should know, forgive me, what rationale did Judge Hudspeth, who is a, I think we'd all concede, a good jurist, what was his rationale for the cap not applying?
Because the government hospital under 4437 is specifically excluded as a health care provider under 4590I.
He didn't go off on constitutional questions.
No, sir. No, sir. Was not decided. He just said that it did not apply to government hospitals, which I understand was also applied in 2 other cases, which are Ingram and Bond, which were also Western District cases, which are cited in the brief. Anyway, so I'm stuck now with a case that winds up here at the Supreme Court from a federal case. And I don't think you have to be a Judge Bork strict constructionist to figure out that under Article 4590I, I don't think they ever envisioned a government hospital applying under that statute. It's certainly wasn't listed and contemplated by the legislature, and if you look at the enumerated reasons under 4590I and the insurance provisions of it, I don't think the federal government's got any business under that statute. But there we are, and here we are. If we look and see who's on the other side of this case, we can see the United States is over there, and they want to apply under 4590I to be a person in the state of Texas. We can also notice that the briefs filed in the case, we have the Chamber of Commerce and the Texas Medical Association and probably every insurance company from here to England that's concerned. And all we have on our side, or my side, is a crippled boy. And he's one of very few crippled, dead, blind people that comes into play under Article 4590I. And that's maybe the essence of the entire problem here, because the numbers in his so-called class are very small. Now, the government, the United States, is going to ask you to try and balance the entire insurance system on the backs of these crippled kids and blind people and dead people, and I would submit to you that Christopher's scoliotic back, which floats, isn't willing to carry any of this, and I doubt any of these other folks are as well. In the 10 years of 4590I, I think there's 7 cases, and I think 4 of which concern the United States government hospitals. Prior to 1977, there was one case, I think Dean Keaton reported in his study. It's such a small group of people that you would think that this is really not a major issue for the court. Well, we, in keeping in mind with Judge Hill's request, there's really 4 ways to go about what to do with 4590I in these cases. The government can play what we call in this business the numbers game, which you can look at the number of people who are responsible for the injury to the child in this case. Or in subsequent cases and previous cases, you see that the government is trying to apply under 4590I as one person. One person as opposed to one entity who is responsible for all of their people under respondeat superior. That's one way to go about the case. The second one, and I'm going to just go real fast over that one, which is the other joint tortfeasor in this case, which is Wyeth Laboratories, is not defined as a health care provider. So they do not have a limit of liability. And this is all briefed out for you basically in the section titled specifically this in our brief. So that's the second way to do it, is if under the Baber rationale of your decision, collective decision, you can see that one party has a limit and one party does not, if that party has one limit as opposed to 3 or 4, which is our position. Third way around this, and you can see that some of the rationale in the cases that came up, Baber at the Beaumont Court, Malone and Heck under the San Antonio Court, and then the Wheat case tried here in Austin, United States District Court. These are cases that apply specific sections of 4590I to specific things. For example, the Beaumont Court in Baber held it was unconstitutional as applied to a hospital. So that's the third way of doing this, and I will get to that one in a second. The fourth way to do it, and this is probably the most important way, is to declare the entire statute under 4590I, the limitation of 1102 through 1104, unconstitutional as violation of equal protection and the Open Courts Act of the Texas Constitution. Now briefly, I wanted to just look at the numbers for you here and show you what the government's trying to do. The government is not trying to be a person in the state of Texas as any other person is. What you have is the certified question, and how does this apply? Well, is the government one person? Well, in this particular case, the court found that the needle was the wrong size, which to us means the hospital stocked the wrong size. The nurse gave the shot in the wrong place. He used the wrong system, and he used the methodology incorrectly, i.e., the system is designed that if you see blood in the barrel of the needle, you do not give the shot. It's the last safety valve in an apparatus to give a shot.
These are all interesting arguments, but they don't bear on the question that was certified to us from the Fifth Circuit. And I've read your brief here, and I understand the arguments you're making, but those are arguments that need to be made in the Fifth Circuit about how many negligent parties there are. I understand you contend that there's more than one negligent party. What I'd like to hear is your analysis of equal protection and due process as to why you contend that Article 4590I is unconstitutional in respect of the cap.
Okay. Well, Judge, I had just in the note, in the opinion, the court is struggling with that question of what do you do with these numbers? And they're saying that is this one defendant for purposes of 4590I, and how do you interpret that one person? My position is, as you all said in Baber, you can dispose of this case without getting to the constitutional issue if one says there's three people here, and we can multiply by three just as well as anybody else can, so there's no issue to decide. And that's the point of the numbers. And it's all laid out in my brief as well, and if I can move on to
Judge Higginbotham didn't ask for our comments about joint and several liability. He asked us for our opinion on the constitutionality.
Judge, that's correct. Judge Higginbotham called me and told me that as well, but my understanding from the last ruling I got from the court was you all were free to decide this issue however you thought fit, that we were not restricted to the one issue of the constitutionality of 4590I. That's what was specifically told to me. And if you look at the entire issue here, there's lots of ways to deal with this thing. But I'll go on from here. The last point really on the numbers game is you really need to look at the Gonzales Act as to the particular sections and how that applies to the United States, that you couldn't sue these people individually anyway, that you then must go in under the United States as the defendant itself. And we feel that simply a respondeat superior argument, and in sum on this, the government is trying to be better than an individual person under the statute. So in other words, if a doctor has an entire staff or a hospital has a staff, each one of those people would be responsible under 4590I. The government is trying to say we are only one, no matter if we have 15 or 20 people that are responsible here. And Mr. Whitehurst's case, which is the Wheat versus the United States, is exactly that. You have different times, different places, different parties. You have I think there's 14 or 15 different tortfeasors in the case. And they're trying to then be treated better than an average anybody who applies under 4590I. So they don't like the system to apply to them like it would to anybody else in the state of Texas. They want to be considered a separate class and a better class. Now, one last thing I had on this, and you must look at 4590I in section 1.02b7. It specifically did not intend or apply to modify the liability laws of the state of Texas in the legal system or in the tort section. So specifically in 4590I, it's telling us that the rest of the law does not change in this area. On the joint and several liability, just briefly.
Counsel, please listen to Judge Kildare.
Okay, well, I'll do
would
that.
Would you please begin your argument on the constitutionality of this statute?
Okay, I will do that.
Thank you.
In the constitutionality argument, there's basically two ways to go with it, and as I briefly set out before, that it is unconstitutional as applied to the government. In Baber, it was a hospital. In Malone versus Hyde, it was a corporation pharmacy that was ruled unconstitutional. In Wheat, Judge Nallon said it was a hospital and a doctor that it was unconstitutional. As the statute is written under the equal protection, it's obviously has nothing to do with the United States. It is patently unreasonable. It has nothing to do with spiraling medical costs. It has nothing to do with Stowers Doctrine. There's no quid pro quo. There's certainly no crisis. And in effect, it creates a separate class for these defendants. It does not meet the court's test under Sachs. And it's unreasonable and arbitrary when applied to the United States. I doubt anybody in the state legislature would say that the statute ever was envisioned to apply for the United States. So if we look to that, we can see that the envisionment of the finders and founders of that argument and that statute would have nothing to do with it.
Counsel, do we have to hold it unconstitutional to say it does not apply to the United States?
Your Honor, I think under the rationale from the original Baber case and from Malone and Hyde and from the Wheat case, I think you can just say as applies to the United States, I think that's unconstitutional. It doesn't meet the merits of the Equal Protection or the Open Courts Act. I think it can be done. It's been done before. And I think if you look at the rationale behind it, it's not a bad theory to go under.
We don't know what the court will do. That'll have to be a matter of the court's discussion and judgment. Will you assume that we're going to address the basic constitutional question?
Yes, sir. Now, what we have, by definition, under the statute, is two select classes. You have a class of victims, which is separate from your usual tort victims. You have catastrophically injured victims who cannot collect in full. If they are wealthy victims, or if they are accomplished, or if they are male victims under 4590I, the possibility exists, and the probability exists, that these people would not be entitled to any pain and suffering under the tort law of the state of Texas. What I mean by that is, under 4590I, the medical section is separate than pain and suffering and economic loss. So lost wage earning capacity and the damages for pain and suffering, emotional, whatever, are together. So in theory, if you took a male child such as Christopher or anybody who is even vaguely a high school graduate and you extrapolate out his earnings for the course of his lifetime, he is over $1 million. At the time of the trial in this case, the limitation was $845,000. So using the example that Judge Huskett gave Christopher $600,000 for a lost wage earning capacity, that would have left him $240,000 for pain and suffering. Today, the statute is almost $1 million. However, the court is probably well aware that the amount of money for lost wage earning capacity on virtually anybody is now over $1 million. That's male. Male high school graduates over $1 million.
Are we talking about loss of wage earning capacity? Is that under the cap?
Yes, sir, it is. The only thing that's not under the cap is medical and attendant care under medical. So in theory, you have another set of people that are plaintiffs, i.e. the ones that are catastrophically injured and injured in such a way they have now lost their total wage earning capacity. The select group of defendants has the statute set up to limit their liability and set up a certain amount of immunity under the statute. So we have a special group of tortfeasors, and then within the group, within this special group, special class, is another class, meaning the doctors, healthcare providers, no one else applies. It's got to be limited by who's listed. Then it's limited again to the ones who catastrophically injure someone. So under the statute, if a person is hurt, but not hurt that badly, the tortfeasor pays him in full. If the person is hurt very badly, the tortfeasor, who is responsible for these grievous injuries, is limited to the amount of money that he pays. So what you have is a paradox of the worst hurt get the least, the most responsible pay the least. And it comes down to, if a doctor runs over somebody in his automobile, he is liable to the full extent of the law. If a doctor runs over the same person with a scalpel or a variety of other medical instruments, he is responsible only to the amount of money set out in 4590I.
Right. You're making an equal protection argument here. Judge Higginbotham, in his opinion, fully discussed equal protection and concluded that under the U.S. Constitution, the statute did not fail under a rational related test. Now, talk about Article 1, Section 3 of the Texas Constitution and tell us why there's any difference between the 14th Amendment and Article 1, Section 3 of the Texas Constitution.
Good, have no problem with that. That's where I am. Under the Equal Protection Statute, the state of Texas has a different test than just the rational basis test. And I believe, Judge Gilgarland, in your article, you allude to the fact that there's a middle tier test. And I happen to agree with your position. The stated purpose of the act listed in 4590I does not outweigh the Texas equal protection. The rational basis is for the legislature, but as the court has ruled on previous occasions, you have what's called the reasonableness, which puts a reasonable purpose behind the statute. Judge Buckmeyer, in the Gibson versus Wagner opinion, puts it very well. He calls it a equal protection argument, rational basis with reasonableness, with due process underpinnings, which is a good way, I think, of looking at it. Do we look and see if the rational basis is there and is it reasonable as applied? Well, we can see you have to look at the purpose of the statute and is there any crisis? Well, in the brief it lists a number of things that there really is no relation to from insurance premiums and claims. There's...
I'm sorry, counsel, I hate to keep interrupting you, but before you go to the facts that you believe make this unconstitutional, discuss further the test that you believe this court should adopt in discussing the issue and whether we should do it under the Texas Constitution.
Okay.
Or under what provision of the Texas Constitution.
Judge, I'll gladly leave out the facts because I think you all have probably been inundated with all of the different facts. What you have in your, and I have the opinion right here, in Sullivan versus University Interscholastic League, I think that's where we started with all of this as to the rationality related to the state's interest and whether the classification is reasonable.
Doesn't Judge Spears in the Sullivan opinion go on the 14th Amendment and not on the Texas Constitution?
That's true, Your Honor. However, in the cases that have come since, and the cases that have used the equal protection argument, which are Baptist Hospital versus Baber, Dieter Hospital versus Estrada, Malone and Hyde versus Holbrook, Wagner and Gibson, all of these arguments are used by the appellate courts to indicate that there is indeed a middle tier that you have to apply the reasonableness, because under the rational basis test, you'll never ever overturn one of these statutes. And I believe it has, it's only been done once. So there's no reasonable basis to look at it. And in the Wagner versus Gibson case, one of the things that Judge Buckmeyer points out is that the constitutional provisions are not subject to marketing conditions. There was no quid pro quo, i.e. the reasonableness that was applied to the individual plaintiffs. So what you have is it reasonable to limit these six or seven different claimants under a statute that really doesn't have any basis to exist at all? If we have the reasonableness under the, quote, Texas experience, as Judge Gonzalez says, where are we going with this statute? Is it logical? Is it reasonable? Is it arbitrary? Well, it is arbitrary when applied to this, because the equal protection of the section is exactly that. The valid purpose, I think you could look and say that there's perhaps a valid purpose, but if it's applied to the rational basis, and then you're looking at how it affects the individuals, these people are denied the equal protection that's written into the Constitution, because the statute was not based on any crisis, and because it, as it applies, it doesn't affect just a small group of people. Those are the only ones concerned here. So it doesn't do what its purpose was to do, and as it applies to the individual people, it doesn't do anything except deprive those most hurt, those most needy, those most entitled to compensation with a limit. All the other people that come before it, they get full compensation. These folks do not. Now the open courts provision under Section 13 is probably the strongest challenge of all. The court's opinion in Sachs sets up the two-pronged test. And is it a cognizable cause of action in the common law that is restricted? I don't think there's any question about it. Look at this judgment. Almost half of the judgment is restricted in this particular case. Is this restriction unnecessary and arbitrary when it's balanced against the purpose of the statute? Here we feel the right outweighs the legislative basis. Under Sachs, the opinion states, its potential to save insurance money on rates was unreasonable when compared to the right of redress of a child. That's exactly what we have here. There's no adequate substitute to obtain any redress. The rights of redress of a paralyzed child are severely restricted. There's no substitute. There's no fund. There's no workers' compensation, and in the brief it lists some of the other states like Nebraska, which sets up a fund. It is, as the Florida case, which is Smith versus the Board of Insurance says, it is a statute that does not apply. Now, Judge Robertson said it is unreasonable to sacrifice a class of litigants for lower malpractice rates, and that's exactly what we have here as well. They are entitled to their day in court. Judge Higginbotham, in his opinion, states that the court is indeed open to them, albeit half open. And I would submit to you all that that's really not the test in Sachs. The test in Sachs is not that they are entitled to be there, but that, of course, they can't get full redress. Sachs does not say the door is half open. It says every person for every injury. Not a half injury, not a half person, just like the Constitution says. The Constitution doesn't limit it that way. And Nelson comes in after Sachs, which does the same thing again. There is no alternative system in this state. The legislature solved the problem legislatively. That is all on the tort system. They did not come up with any type of alternative system like they did in Nebraska or anyplace else. So just like anybody else, this particular case violates the open courts provision, as Sachs and Nelson showed. This door being half open is not quite correct, because there's a substantial loss, as I pointed out to you previously, whether these individuals can get full compensation, and if you have an individual who's entitled to compensation because he is a male who can make over $1 million a year, he's then not entitled to anything under the rationale of 4590I, because he reaches the cap on his economic loss alone.
Do you have any comment if we were to say that the limitations were unconstitutional under the open court provision, some rationale that the court adopted, which would trigger Section 1103
yes, sir.
Of the Act, that would substitute then $150,000 for non-pecuniary type of damages? Do you address that in this case?
Yes.
What do you ask us to do if we get to a second step situation?
The problem with 1103 is it is probably as bad or worse than 1102, because in that particular case, you have the same arguments, the same rationale, i.e. the open court still limits the plaintiffs under the Constitution to a less than adequate amount of money that they are entitled to from a jury and or a judge. The same arguments on the equal protection, the same arguments on the no quid pro quo, the same arguments on an alternative system, the same arguments as to the door being only half open apply. There really is no distinction, and if you read that statute, you come to the same conclusion, like, why do you have this? Because it doesn't add anything for you. In other words, that's what it says is we revert to $150,000. It doesn't say you now can go in front of a three-judge panel and you don't have to go to a jury. It doesn't say we have an alternative relief fund for you. It sets up nothing. It's the same system. It just cuts you back even further. So the safeguards, what you're talking about in Sachs and in the equal protection area, are missing under both sections of the statute. They give you no basis, and the basis for the statute existing under 4590I are still the same. So it's specious logic, because the in going in both directions, you still can't stand on either leg.
We can come back to that in the flow.
Okay.
Thank you, Ken.
Mr. James Spears will present argument for respondent.
Counsel, before you get started, I need to determine if I must recuse myself. I have no idea who you are, but what is your middle name?
M. Milton.
Milton. Are you any relatives from around Darlington, South Carolina?
No, sir. My grandfather came back in the early 1900s. Chase Pancho Villa, but he was from Greenville-Spartanburg area.
Greenville-Spartanburg?
Yeah.
Well, I think we're related, but it's so remote.
Yes, sir. I think it was back to Pancho Villa's time,
Your Honor. Interest in this lawsuit, I don't think.
I don't think so, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Would the marshal get the lights?
Good morning. May it please the court.
Thank you, Judge Riff.
I'm James Spears, representing the defendant, United States, the appellant for the Fifth Circuit, the respondent in court today. This case stems from an Army hospital injection of a penicillin derivative into a small child that was negligently administered. The judge found that the injection had been negligently administered and that it had been injected in the wrong area of the child's buttocks, that the nurse had failed to take proper procedures to prevent unnecessary undue penetration of needle, and had failed to detect and take action when blood appeared in the barrel of the shot. On appeal, in the district court found those particular aspects of liability and awarded the plaintiffs the following amounts: approximately $498,000 as present value for past and future medicals until plaintiff reaches maturity, $350,000 in present value of medicals accruing after the plaintiff's 18th birthday, a $600,000 amount for loss of future income, and $1.5 million for pain and suffering. That award against the United States was reduced by $400,000, the amount of the settlement the plaintiff reached with Wyeth Laboratories. On appeal, the United States appealed on the ground that the court refused to apply the law limiting non-medical damages as established under Article 4590I. There were other parts of the case which were appealed and argued, but that's essentially where we are here today. Liability was conceded on appeal by the United States. Section 1102A basically limits its damage awards to $500,000. Section 1102B of 4590I, damage cap does not apply to medicals and custodial care. And then, of course, 11.04, which is on a CPI indexing, which would bring the $500,000 cap to a current value in excess of $900,000. Question presented, will plaintiff plaintiff's argument on appeal was that Texas law does not purport to cover federal hospitals. Response by the Fifth Circuit was liability stems from the Federal Tort Claims Act. It's a waiver of sovereign immunity. Regardless of what Texas purports to do with federal hospital, the FTC places federal hospital in the same situation as a private health care provider in the state of Texas. I think that's understood, that that's the way that the United States waives its sovereign immunity in that respect, because if it did not, local jurisdictions could pass certain statutes which would place liability on the United States with impunity. And that's part of the waiver of sovereign immunity and recognizing the federalism interest of making sure that we're subject to state law, as is anyone else. The federal government and the Federal Tort Claims Act just simply has not agreed to be subject by special laws enacted by the states. The question came up as whether the United States waived by not raising 11.02 defense as an affirmative defense under the federal rule. The court ruled that our defense was timely submitted and that there was no prejudice to the plaintiff in that action. So then the question came up was whether the cap violates the due process equal protection provisions of the state constitution, and it's upon that basis the question is submitted to this court. Now, the plaintiff relies upon three provisions of the Texas Constitution and urging constitutional infirmity of Section 4590I. They are Article 1, Section 3, the Equal Rights or Equal Protection provision of the Texas Constitution, Article 1, Section 13, the Open Courts provision, and Article 1, Section 19, the Due Course of Law provision. Now, the burden of persuasion under any one of these theories continues to be on the party who is asserting its unconstitutionality, in this case, the petitioner. There's presumption in favor of the constitutionality of the act of the state of an act of the state legislature, which of course is at risk here. I want to focus my argument and my principal comments in opening on the open courts provision, because while I intend to address both the equal protection argument and the due course of law provision, the open court provision I think is most important in this case. Because
in discussing that open courts provision, there are about seven states that declared their cap unconstitutional. Would you discuss, I know Florida based it on their open courts provision in the Smith case. Would you discuss the basis in New Hampshire, North Dakota, Illinois, Ohio, on what basis those states declared their cap provisions unconstitutional?
Well, Your Honor, I'm familiar to a certain extent with those cases. I've read them. I have not gone into an expounded, in-depth, detailed analysis of those cases.
Have you read Smith?
Yes, sir, I have. Yes, sir.
Smith very clearly was based on it on the Florida Open Courts.
I believe it was also based upon the Florida's right trial by jury provision, if I'm not mistaken, too, Your Honor.
Well, we have a similar right.
Yes, Your Honor. This is the provision, though, and I think the open court provision is the one that we must focus on, because it is that provision which this court has ruled, which provides protections above and beyond the due process equal protections that are afforded by our 14th Amendment to the federal constitution under federal constitutional analyses. And I recognize that there are other lower courts in Texas which have held to the contrary, that these other provisions provide expanded rights in the Texas constitution as well. To this date, to the best of our reading of the Texas case law, this court has focused on the open courts provision to find additional protections for the people of the state of Texas beyond that which is guaranteed by our federal constitution. Article 1, Section 13, in pertinent part, reads, all courts shall be open and every person for an injury done, all courts shall be open and every person for an injury done him in his land, goods, or personal reputation shall have a remedy by due course of law. It's our assertion that the open court provision means exactly what it says. Legislature may not unreasonably restrict the right of a plaintiff to pursue a cause of action otherwise provided by law. Recent decision by this court in LaCroix versus Hanlon, I think, very effectively charts the development and application of this doctrine in the state of Texas. In early days, it focused primarily upon the ability of a claimant to find a court which could hear his claim. In O'Shea versus Toohey and Runge and Company versus White, the court was focusing on early days of this state, counties which did not have courts of law, where plaintiffs could not meet the jurisdictional requirements established by the state legislature. And indeed, in those cases, the courts basically set aside the jurisdictional statutes and the filing requirements that they may apply to those particular litigants, allowing them to perfect their rights, to adjudicate their rights, otherwise provided by law in an alternative forum. Later cases dealt with laws which indirectly deprived the claimant of his right or access to sue in court to assert his claim otherwise provided by law. Dillingham dealt with this case. This court dealt with the supersedeas bond requirements and the owner's provisions that it had limited the ability of an appellant to secure an appeal. In Sachs was another case where essentially a limitation period enacted as part of the malpractice reform effort would have effectively totally deprived the minor of his right to sue. The limitation period was particularly egregious simply because it presented the third side of a bracket which would prevent this plaintiff, the minor plaintiff, from going to court. Because Moat versus Fillmore barred any kind of a suit by a minor, Felderhall versus Felderhall barred the ability of the minor to sue his parents for refusing to sue in his behalf, and then Sachs versus Volder dealt with the limitations period which would have required the child to maintain a suit by age 14. Basically caught in this Bermuda Triangle of inability to sue, the court basically said, no, we can't do that. If the finder has a right under Texas law to assert and sue in medical malpractice, then we've got to afford that person that right, and limitations can't otherwise restrict it.
Why is the same rule rationale applicable to the situation where you, while you don't restrict it, you limit it?
Well, Your Honor, I think it comes down to a real basic question, and that's the heart of the argument today. Because it is one thing to suggest that the court, that the legislature cannot restrict the ability of a person to get to and otherwise pursue a legitimate cause of action. But it is a far different thing to say that the state legislature cannot modify or amend or otherwise alter the causes of action that it allows under state law.
Well, now that's a whole other question. You're contending that $500,000 limitation is constitutional.
Yes, Your Honor.
That it is a reasonable alteration of the right of redress.
Yes, Your Honor, I guess. But there's a question in terms of, because the point that I'm trying to make is that the plaintiff's theory of this case would suggest that there is some substantive prohibition or limitation on the ability of the state legislature to change common law rules, the common law rules of decision. And I submit that that is taking the analysis set forth in Sachs and all of the cases under the open courts provision far beyond any level that this court has been willing to recognize in the past.
You're saying it's constitutional to impose a $500,000 limit?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
But would it
be constitutional to impose a $100,000 limit?
I think it would be constitutional.
Would it be constitutional to impose a $1 limit?
It would be constitutional for the state legislature to rescind the remedy altogether.
In spite of our constitutional guarantee that the court shall be open to redress grievances, the legislature could put a $1 cap on the recovery for that grievance?
It's a remedy that's allowed by law, Your Honor. And I do believe that to come to a new different conclusion would essentially take the common law and elevate it to a constitutional dimension, which I don't think that the Constitution does, nor has any act of the legislature purported to do it. I would call the court's attention to Article 16, Section 48. The existing laws continue in force section of our Constitution. It talks about it's all laws or parts of law now enforced in the state of Texas, which are not repugnant to the Constitution of the United States or to this Constitution, shall continue and remain in force as the laws of this state until they expire by their own limitations or shall be amended or repealed by the legislature. It's an interesting provision. It says several things that are pertinent here. Number one, it is the Constitution, only the Constitution, which is given primacy over all other laws. Second, all other laws are subordinate to the Texas Constitution and, of course, the United States Constitution. And third, all laws other than the Constitution of the state of Texas may be modified or repealed by the legislature of the state of Texas. It's quite clear that the framers did not intend to elevate law to a constitutional level. It's no indication that the framers intended any substantive limitations upon the ability of the legislature to amend or repeal existing law. The question then is the common law part of this body of law, which can be freely amended or repealed by the legislature? Article 1, the Texas Revised Civil Statutes, reads as follows. Common law of England, so far as it is not inconsistent with the Constitution and laws of this state, shall together with the Constitution and laws be the rule of decision, and shall continue in force until altered or repealed by the legislature. It's quite obvious from old Article 1, from the earliest enactments by the state legislature, enactments contemporaneous to the framing of our Constitution, that the common law was deemed to be amendable by the legislature at will, and there is no limitation, and I underscore no limitation, on the ability of the legislature to so amend. This is recodified in Section 5.005001 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code. Rule of decision in this state consists of those portions of the common law of England that are not inconsistent with the Constitution or laws of this state, the Constitution of the state, and the laws of this state. The reviser's note there is fairly interesting. Revise this revision and omit the source of law material relating to the continuance of the common law until altered or repealed by the legislature. Since the legislature has the inherent authority to alter or repeal law, that material is unnecessary.
Well, the legislative enactments are always subject to judicial reviews for reasonableness or whatever standard a given court chooses to adopt.
That's right.
We may argue here about which standard of review is proper in a case like this. But there's got to be some standard of review to which any legislative enactment would have to stand muster.
Yes, sir, Your Honor, and I believe that's fundamental due process. Again, if we go back to the open courts provision.
Is that where it is, under due process?
I believe it's under the due course of law provision, because, Your Honor, if I may, again, going back to the open courts provision, I think that if the legislature restricts an ability of a person to otherwise get to a remedy that is otherwise provided by law, that's where the open courts provision comes into play. But if what it's doing is modifying the underlying rule of law that is to be applied in the case, then I think we're back into the due course of law provision, because again, if I may, go back to Section 13. All courts shall be open, every person have an injury done to him, his lands, goods, and personal reputation shall have remedy by a due course of law. It seems to me if there's any inherent limitation on the ability of the Texas legislature to alter or amend, rescind, repeal a rule of decision that would be applicable under common law, it would be the due process clause, the due course of law clause, and not the open course provision.
All right, and then what standard of review did we apply? We've settled that, at least from your standpoint.
Well, Your Honor, if I could, before I go to that, I'd like to give a couple of backups in case, okay. I hope I've convinced you, but I want to give you a couple of other reasons,
trying to be
confessed,
too. I'm trying to get both of y'all to settle down on what standard of review we apply and under which provision are you asking us to write the opinion?
I understand, Your Honor. I wanted to get the open courts provision out of the way first, okay, so we could get to that. And so I guess what I'm saying is that even if we were talking about access, I think this statute passes muster under Sachs versus Volver. Has a cognizable cause of action been restricted? Answer, no. The legislature is using its power to amend the law has modified an underlying cause of action. Is this restriction unreasonable? No, it places a generous limit on non-medical damages. Does not deprive plaintiff of his cause of action. This is unlike the result that was reached in O'Shea, Sachs, and Dillingham. Second, unlike McCroy,
you're characterizing the question incorrectly on that second test in Sachs. Isn't it whether or not the legislature has provided a reasonable alternative? Isn't that the second test in Sachs versus Votler?
I would think that the second test in Sachs versus Votler goes to really to the LaCroix analysis, and that really gets down to the reasonableness, which in my earlier discussions with Judge Hill, I think goes to the question of due process, the due course of law provision.
Due course of law.
Rational basis? Yes, Your Honor, I believe that's where we are. Sorry,
under
it took me so long to get that to you.
Case of Judge Ray authored, no,
yes, Your Honor. I think that, well, that one was primarily looking at, because you look at due process and equal protection, they tend to come together in these kinds of analyses to a certain extent. One carries with it what the other carries with it. And I think that that's what due process and equal protection do tend to meld. They do in the federal system, and they do in the state system as well. It talks about what is the rational basis behind legislative enactment.
Why should there be perhaps consideration given to a heightened standard of review where you're dealing with issues of damages as distinguished from whether someone can participate in extracurricular activities?
Well, Your Honor, I think the problem is that once one goes to a heightened standard review, it's a question of trying to cabin it. The point is that the rational basis test serves us well. It provides necessary deference to the will and the views of the legislature, and gives the legislature the ability to change in the face of very rapidly changing conditions. Not saying that the legislature is infallible, but it's with that body that we, in both the state and the federal system, have reposited the most fundamental authority in our government.
Is over-inclusiveness a part of the federal rational basis?
Over-inclusiveness, and I think it would get down to a case like, for example, the Sullivan decision, which really over-inclusiveness had nothing to do with what the legislature, in that case the UIL, was trying to achieve, Judge.
But my question was, is over-inclusiveness a part of the federal rational basis test?
Yes, Your Honor, it is.
It is.
Yes, Your Honor, it is. Now, strict scrutiny is the other one, Judge Hill, and that's really where you've got a suspect classification or you've got a fundamental right. I haven't seen anyone really argue that that would be appropriately utilized in this particular case.
I heard the suggestion that we should use a middle tier.
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm not quite sure which cases counsel had in mind when he said that we had written on middle tier. Are you aware of any writings of this court on middle tier?
This court has not written any middle tier cases. The cases that stand for the middle tier, and I believe the cases cited by counsel, were the lower court decisions in some of these cases that have arisen that are cited in the briefs, Baber and some of the other cases. But those cases all stem from a case that originally arose in the state of North Dakota. And there was an immediate level of scrutiny was to be applied when they were reviewing the malpractice cap enacted by their legislature. And essentially what they said in North Dakota, the Supreme Court in Arneson versus Olson said, there must be a close correspondence between statutory classification and the legislative goals. Now, again, no Supreme Court decision by this state has ever adopted that as the line. Second, there's no federal precedent in terms of the protections afforded by our federal constitution under the 14th Amendment. Indeed, existing federal precedent analyzing the specific question of damage caps by the federal courts, utilizing 14th Amendment due process and equal protection analyses, has specifically rejected constitutional attacks against damage limitations. I would submit, again, Judge Higginbotham's decision here in Lucas and a Ninth Circuit decision in Hoffman. That case is cited and included in our brief. So the result of adopting this North Dakota rationale, this North Dakota intermediate scrutiny level, would essentially be one of loosening Texas from the moorings established by the 14th Amendment. Heightened scrutiny. Now, this is something that I think the court ought to very carefully consider before it takes that step. Because the North Dakota determination in terms of equal protection stems from another North Dakota anomaly. And that is that they still recognize substantive due process rights in North Dakota, where modern jurisprudence in the United States over the last 40 years has done everything it can to limit that doctrine. Because it conjures up the kind of judicial overreaching to strike down the progressive legislation of the earliest days of the New Deal. The substantive due process is a power that can be sorely abused. Because essentially what it does is that it puts courts in the hands of the legislature, puts the courts in the legislature's back pocket to decide, is this exactly the best way to go about doing, as opposed to stepping back and taking the rational basis test that serves us under the federal constitution.
Well, if we go on rational basis in due course, how can you justify, under that analysis, segregating out one part of the tort law, that is the medical side of it, and giving this special dispensation?
Well, Your Honor, I think, again,
state policy, how is that rational?
It's rational in as much as it just didn't come out of the blue. Let me, if I may, just for a second, compare this with the North Dakota statute that was struck down in Arneson. In Arneson, it proceeded from the standpoint that there were, quote, a lot of illegitimate claims being handled in the courts. In other words, spurious claims were getting awarded. Okay? And so they just put a total cap of $300,000 on any medical malpractice case. We're not talking one that was indexed. We're not talking one that's limited to non-medicals. We're talking the whole enchilada. And you simply could not get, if you were injured and your medicals ran $400,000, that's just too bad. That was the extent of the cap. And it all proceeded because it was from the North Dakota legislature was trying to keep illegitimate claims from being paid. Now, that has no rational basis, Your Honor. That has absolutely no rational basis at all, because how can one distinguish between a legitimate and an illegitimate claim based upon the amount of money? The answer is you can't. The second thing is that it was a total cap, and it does work a very extreme hardship on seriously injured claimants. I think here, Your Honor, we do have a rational basis. I think the legislature didn't lightly walk into this area. It proceeded after, you know, two sessions of consideration, and indeed up until this very day, the legislature is still wrestling with the question of how can we balance the rights of individuals who are injured and the need to provide low-cost, adequate health care for all Texans. That's something that the legislature of the state of Texas has been wrestling with for a number of years. This specific provision came out of the Tort Law Study Commission that was chaired by Paige Keaton, and indeed out of reams and reams of legislative testimony and hearings on this matter. One of the concerns they had was, in this situation, is that 5% of the plaintiffs, 5% of the plaintiffs are the ones that were very seriously injured, were receiving essentially 40% of the monies paid out by the health care providers in claims. And a substantial chunk of that didn't come from medical and custodial care. And that's why this legislature very carefully parsed that out and said, we're not going to cap that. That's not a problem. It came from those areas where we have a much more difficult time in coming up with an objective measure of damage. To a certain extent, you've got a problem with future income. To even a greater extent, you've got a problem with joint and several with pain and suffering. And indeed, if you go back to the Keaton Commission, you will find that the Keaton Commission, one of the recommendations considered there, was an absolute cap of pain and suffering of $100,000, which would have been far more draconian than I think the fairly generous decision that was ultimately reached by the state legislature.
It's not right to quote that out. In a vacuum, the Keaton Commission also recommended the Patient's Compensation Fund, which the legislature chose not to enact into law. Isn't that true?
That's right, Your Honor. There were a lot of recommendations.
Also, that get right back to Sachs versus Bottler, where you have got to provide a reasonable alternative?
Sachs versus Bottler, I don't think, stands for the proposition that the state legislature cannot amend the common law rule of decision. I think what it says is that once you put that option out there, once you say, Your Honor, once you say that you've got a right to recover up to this amount, you can't put some arbitrary block in there through a statute of limitation or making them file in a courthouse that doesn't exist to stop them from being able to utilize those rights that are afforded them by law. But it does not stand for the proposition that the state legislature cannot amend the rules of decisions established by the common law. If it did stand for that, we would have courthouses. Under the old common law, you had a right as a debtor that you couldn't collect money out of or as a creditor, if you couldn't collect money out of a debtor, you could have him sent to a poorhouse. We don't have poorhouses in the state of Texas. Before, the legislature did away with that a long time ago. We don't also, quite thankfully, don't have the rule in Shelley's case to deal with anymore, because the legislature retains the ability to change the common law. It's not a millstone welded around the legislature's neck.
Counsel,
that's the difference.
You answered a while ago that the legislature could reduce the amount of the claims to $300,000. And even to $1.
Under the open courts provision, Your Honor, that's right.
Could they abolish the cause of action entirely?
I think under the open courts provision, they could. But would it necessarily make pass constitutional scrutiny under the due course of law provision? Perhaps not. And I think that's what I was trying to get to with Judge Hill. There you've got to find a rational basis test. There you've got to have a rational basis for making that decision. I submit here that this wasn't something that the legislature lightly got into. And indeed, to contrast, if I may, with the North Dakota decision. One of the findings by the Texas State Legislature was that the filing of legitimate, not illegitimate, but legitimate health care liability claims in Texas is a contributing factor affecting medical professional liability rights. They knew what they were doing. They understood what they were doing. They knew that they were going to be affecting some legitimate claims. But nonetheless, they said that this is important to ensure continued level of adequate health care in the state of Texas. That's a decision that the legislature made. Those were the facts. It didn't lightly reach that decision. And I submit, Your Honor, that there's an ample amount of authority in the state of Texas in the case law established by this court and by the courts of the state of Texas that this court should be very deferential of the facts that are found. I mean, essentially, we can come up with law review articles that can say that the liability crisis was over with 15 years ago to other articles that say it's depending upon us now and it's waiting around our necks. That's, again, there's no way for a court to judge through that. That's what the legislature's job is, and it should be deferential to the job of the legislature. If I may, a couple of real quick points to finish out. I know my time is running late, and I don't want to hold this court at all and be on time. But to respond to a couple of the questions that Judge Hill offered, the question of the interpretation of the statute in terms of the multiple plaintiffs, I believe that was a question that you wanted us to address, Judge Hill. I think that the first of all, that interpretation of the statute is directly and irretrievably at odds with the plain language of the Act. Section 1102A says the limit of civil liability for damages of the health care provider shall not exceed. Now, you know, here the plaintiff's parent's claim for damages is dependent upon the plaintiff. It's not an independent action. It's simply an additional element of damages in the same action. Again, if I may, I've got a few too many pieces of paper up here.
If you need a few extra minutes.
Well, to draw a parallel to the Texas Tort Claims Act, there you have a language which is far different. It doesn't talk about the liability of the health care provider. What it talks about is the amount of recovery a person may have. And so if I may contrast that language, liability of the unit of local government in this chapter is limited to money damages of a maximum amount for $100,000 for each person and $300,000 for each single occurrence of bodily injury. That's in the Remedies Code Section 101.023 in terms of its recodification. And this court has upheld the fact that that basically restricts the amount that the defendant, local government, pays. Contrast that language to the one in the malpractice claim, which is written from the standpoint of the defendant. And it would be very difficult for this court to suggest that the Texas Tort Claims Act provision says that the defendant only pays once, whereas the medical health care provider's statute says the defendant pays however many other people with claims that you can come up with. I think the better rule is the one that this court, under the Texas Tort Claims Act, announced in Cooksey, City of Austin versus Cooksey, where it essentially said per person means persons injured, rather than those persons who suffer a loss as a result of an injury to someone else. I think that's the better rule of decision. It's also consistent, I believe, with this court's decision in the Madisonville School District case. The Madisonville Independent School District, the question there was, again, this is another question that's been raised in this case, is does a person covered by a cap, when he is a joint tortfeasor with one not covered by the cap, lose the protections of the cap? Madisonville Independent School District said no. But an interesting aspect of that case was that in the decision issued by this court, that the two claims of the parents, one was in excess of the cap, one was less than the cap, were both reduced so that when added together they did not exceed the cap. Whereas if the plaintiff's construction of how one gets and works the cap in terms of multiple claimants had been applied in that case, the father's award in Madisonville of $120,000 would have been reduced by $20,000 to $100,000, and the mother allowed to recover her full amount. I think that's the way to deal. It certainly is more consistent with the terms of the statute, the plain language of the statute. It's more consistent with the other interpretations rendered by this court in other contexts. It's a more natural reading of it, and I think, as the Amicus Texas Medical Association brief points out, I think it's much more consistent with the views of the authors of that provision when it was offered. Judge, my time is up.
Do you feel you've had adequate time?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe I have.
We'd like the advice of the Fifth Circuit as to who should, in tradition of these certified questions in other cases, who has been accorded the petitioner's position and response.
Well, Your Honor, I certainly have no objections. If I have a full and fair and adequate hearing as I've had here this morning, I don't really care what I do with first or second.
Initial proposition, we did what we thought was proper in one field that they've been disadvantaged by.
No objections from the United States, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Here comes Lucas and rebuttal.
Judge, in rebuttal, I think I should address the issue on the Madisonville School District first. Government counsel usually will always revert, I should say always revert back to sovereignty argument when you're getting into the Federal Tort Claims Act and the Texas Tort Claims Act. I guess it goes with being government counsel. I guess that's part of your union card or something. But it really doesn't have anything to do with 4590I. For example, under the Madison School District case, the state is jointly and severally liable under the Texas Tort Claims Act up to the limit of its sovereignty. So that is a sovereignty argument, and it has really nothing to do with what we have in this case, i.e., the Federal Tort Claims Act has no limitation of liability, and under 4590I, there is a limitation of liability. However, the court has applied the Baber rationale under 4590I. So if you don't do what you need to do under the Baber rationale, you have done what should occur in this case, which is you are now responsible for the other person's liability up until that limit, assuming the limit is any good. So it's very hard to run back into a sovereignty argument that has no basis in the case, and it has no basis for the United States government, and it certainly has no basis under joint and several liability under the Baber rationale. The court and I, admittedly, are struggling with the standards of review for 4590I, and I would submit to the court that if one reads the court's opinions in Spring Branch, in Whitworth versus Bynum, in Sullivan, and in Price v. Price, one comes to the conclusion, reading those with then reading the Sachs case, the Nelson versus Cruson, and the Nagel versus Nelson cases, that we are indeed at a place where we have what's called a middle tier. If you see in Judge Spear's opinion in Sullivan that we're talking about equal analysis still requires us to reach and determine a question, the question of whether the classifications drawn in the statute are reasonable in light of the purpose of the statute. Using that, using then the quid pro quo that's required, if you look then at the language of the Constitution itself, when it's calling for separate privileges, separate emoluments, and all free men, you can see that that's really where the court has been for quite some time. So we have, as Judge Buckmeyer said in Wagner versus Gibson, an equal protection with due process underpinnings. And we can call that a middle tier or whatever, but you look then to see the purposes of the statute, which in the plaintiff's position is not valid. You then look at the trade-offs for it. They are not valid. They are not reasonable under the circumstances. There is no quid pro quo. And then you take that and you see where the court has been in Sachs, in Nelson, and in Nagel. You can see then when the two are applied, which has happened now both with Judge Buckmeyer in Wagner versus Gibson and Judge Nowlin in Wheat, they use this type of language. For example, in Wheat, the purpose of the statute to provide affordable health care has not been met. They use the language that Dieter has all over the place. There is no connection between premiums and litigation. The rights of the plaintiffs cannot be substantially altered. And then taking that with the applications and the tests in Sachs, and as Justice Kilgarland said, where is the alternative system? There is no alternative system. In this particular case, Christopher Lucas was awarded $1.5 million for pain and suffering. It was awarded by a United States District Judge, not some teary-eyed bunch of old ladies that were in the back row. This was someone who looked at it very rationally. Paralyzing a one-year-old child is something that's going to bring with it a lot of baggage. That's exactly what happened. So if we look and see where is the alternative under 4590I, the alternative is that he's entitled to $240,000. That's a substantial restriction of his common law rights. I don't think there's any question about it. If the case were tried today, he wouldn't get anything for his pain and suffering. He would just get his loss of wage earning capacity. Now, the government thinks that these are some sort of numbers picked out of a hat or something when one is trying a case. And as you all know, even the Fifth Circuit in the Culver Two Boat Company case, they have now different areas where they can specify exactly how much and what is a alternative method to find loss of wage earning capacity. So it is not mumbo jumbo, and it's not something that you pick a figure out of the air and guess. Is there anything which then restricts it? Yes, there is. We have this statute that says if you are badly hurt, we are very sorry, we cannot compensate you. There is no alternative. The alternative is we shift you back to the state of Texas, to the El Paso County Hospital, to the Bexar County Hospital, or whatever, or the Texas Rehab Commission. That's where you're shifted to. Well, that's not an alternative that's written into the statute. So what we then have is this purpose reasonable, or is it arbitrary? And we're balancing it. Well, we can see that it is not reasonable under the circumstances because it never did, this statute never did what it was supposed to do. Has health care costs gone down in 10 years? No, they haven't. Does it address anything as to, as Judge Kilgallen was mentioning, some of the other states? No, it doesn't. What do you have then? You have a statute then that restricts a very, very, very small number of people from full compensation, where these people are given no alternative. These people are given absolutely no other rights, no matter under what system they want to go under. There's nowhere to go. So is that reasonable? No, it's not. Can we then look and see if these alternative rights that they were not given, can they be given? Well, perhaps in the next statute. If they ever get that far, they can be given. But in this particular statute, it does not exist. They had no basis to go anywhere, and that leaves the Lucas family, father, mother, and son, with nowhere to go.
Counsel, assuming that the legislature has the right to change the common law, and that they may provide a cap if they additionally provide a fund to compensate the plaintiff over and above the cap, must the fund over and above the cap provide enough to cover the judgment or the verdict of the jury, or can that be limited?
I don't think it can be done that way. My opinion is they could set up a system such as in Nebraska where they did that, where you can get into a compensation fund. I think under the rationale of the Sachs case, we then get, is this reasonable? Is this alternative then reasonable? Can get back to Justice Kilgallen's argument, can it be a dollar? Well, is a dollar reasonable? I don't think so. Can it be $10 million and somebody can say, well, that's reasonable? But I think the situation that we have now has no alternative. if they set up an alternative, that perhaps would at least get them into the next step under open courts, for example, under workers' compensation, which is, I think, the type of situation that you have there.
Counsel, can they abolish the cause of action? The legislature abolish the cause of action?
I don't think so. I think that one of the things the government was missing is the legislature can't change the Constitution. The cause of action under the state of Texas exists. And as the court knows, the requirements for proving a malpractice case are fairly stringent. These are not easy cases, as the illusion is. They're very difficult cases. And I don't think the legislature then at its leisure, eliminates under the open courts provision and under the equal protection rights that an individual has in this state. I don't think they can eliminate the cause of action. It can't be done. And I think especially to eliminate part of the cause of action is even worse. That if you had nobody in the cause of action for whatever reason, that I don't think it could hold up under judicial scrutiny.
You're not suggesting that the legislature can't limit, abolish, or otherwise restrict causes of action or place reasonable restrictions on the bringing of that cause of action, are you?
Judge, that's exactly what I'm saying. I think it's just like as Justice Ray said, I think they can do something that's reasonable. If you look at the Sachs test, then you have to get to the second part, which is it reasonable for the stated purpose of whatever they're doing? So I think, it can be done. Can it be done in this particular case? Under 4590, I do not think it is done. So that's more or less a fait accompli. It's not. Can it be done? Maybe.
It was done in workers' comp.
Right, it was done in workers' comp. And I agree with you. It can be done, but there's got to be the trade-off. Where's the quid pro quo?
Well, in Middleton, the workers' comp case, it was done by providing a reasonable alternative when they took away Commonwealth causes of action.
That's correct. And that's what I'm inartfully stating it, but I agree with you that, yes, the legislative can do it, but it has to be a reasonable alternative under you all's rationale. And I'm done unless anybody else has any other questions.
Thank you, counsel. Thank all counsel. That completes the business. Court Marshall will please adjourn the court.
Oye, 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 the Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned, subject to call.